and thanks for the invitation to come. It seems like a wonderful place. So I'm going to talk about this. Maybe title was maybe a little bit too ambitious because there's so many things going on. So I'm going to talk mostly about the stuff that we're doing at Fermilab, but I tried to make it the presentation a little bit more general than that. So I also, I spent most of my career working on searches for WIMPs. And it's interesting to contrast the WIMP field with the axion field because they both started at about the same time in the mid-1980s. But the history is dramatically different. So like, in the WIMP searches, I guess I could characterize this as a competition between experimentalists and theorists. And we were winning, you guys were losing. I mean, I have to avoid these military analogies, but you were constantly proposing, parameter space from supersymmetry up here, and we were constantly pushing past those frontiers. And the theory was just in full retreat until essentially it seems that we're about to wipe you out. So I would characterize it as a full victory of experimentalists versus theorists. But then we're going to reach, the field is going to come to an end in the next decade as we reach the sensitivity floor from neutrinos from solar and atmospheric sources. But on the axion side, the theorists are still winning because a long time ago, this band, and this is the axion to photon coupling versus mass, this band for the QCD axion was identified with the KSVZ and DFSZ models approximately defining the edges. And, there are a number of experiments now, but really only ADMX, and then most recently over the summer, a Korean group called CAP managed to get into this band. But generally, the whole space is open over many decades, and there hasn't been nearly as much experimental activity. But now that's changing because it seems that every month, a new idea for axion detection is published. And there are dozens and dozens of ideas now, but even things that are really being pursued are growing every year. So there are a lot of the things are variations on Pierre Sekivy's resonant cavity idea, pioneered by ADMX and now with Haystack and CAP. And CAP's the Korean group. It's actually a kind of a conglomeration with a bunch of different experiments. And then at low frequencies, there are lumped element searches with essentially LC oscillators. And then there are the dish antennas that were the subject of my trip here. I'm going to talk about these more, especially about our idea called BRASS. BRED. BRASS is the competition in Europe. There's some things I won't talk much about, the dielectric radiator experiments, Mad Max and Orpheus, plasma heliscopes, their nuclear magnetic resonance techniques. And then there are things which don't depend on the cosmic axion background at all, but involve, conversion of laser light into axions, then passing through a wall, and then reconversion back into photons, or studying axions from the sun. So there's this huge diversity of techniques, and I think the story is going to repeat itself. We'll do what we did for the WIMPs over the last 20 years with all of these new techniques and sensor technologies becoming available. So the experiments I'm going to talk about all involve the electromagnetic coupling. And I'm sure you guys have seen this before. So besides when you have an axion field around the Earth, you have an additional classical field, which is often called A. And this represents the amplitude of the dark matter. There are plane wave solutions for this scalar field A that oscillate with a frequency corresponding to the dark matter mass. And then Maxwell's equations get these additional terms with the great spatial gradient of A and the time derivative of A. And so we're looking for these additional terms in Maxwell's equations because the dark matter is not very clumpy. The spatial gradients are presumably heavily suppressed. And so most experiments are looking for this time derivative term. And if you kind of squint at this, you can add what I'll call a fictitious electric current, which is proportional to an externally imposed, first of all, get a big magnet. All the experiments start with the biggest magnet that you can get. And in these conditions, you could describe a fictitious electric current proportional to the magnetic field in dA dt. And that's this term here. And so this then has many parallels with the conventional electron electric current. And by doing this, I'm allowed, then I can appeal to all kinds of intuitions we have about what happens when you have a oscillating electric current. So you get just an ordinary looking Maxwell's equation that has del cross B d dt equals this fictitious current. And so in just in pictures, you've got the magnetic field, and then you have a parallel fictitious electric current that's oscillating. And then since you've got that oscillating electric current, you know that you've got a circulating magnetic field. It's going back and forth and back and forth, wrapping around the electric current. And you also have a parallel real electric field, nothing fictitious about it, that's oscillating back and forth perpendicular to the magnetic field. And then it turns out that the relative strength of this electric and magnetic response have to do with the Compton wavelength of the axion and its size compared to the size of the apparatus. If the wavelength is really big compared to the magnet, let's say, then it's the magnetic part that is the dominant response. And if the wavelength is small, much smaller than the magnet, then it's the electric that's the dominant response. And so you could start right here. Like for an experimentalist, the most obvious thing is to search for the magnetic field by just taking an electric wire, a transformer, and wrapping it around these oscillating magnetic field lines and taking it out into some kind of very low noise amplifier, perhaps a squid, and then looking for that oscillating signal in the in the current that is induced in that transformer coil. So this can also be done in a toroidal geometry. This attracted a lot of attention, was proposed probably 10 years ago now, because the pickup coil in this case is in a region with no real magnetic field, which was considered, that obviously has advantages in terms of reducing the noise that you would expect to have, because the vibrations in this coil will produce a signal. So both of those things are being pursued. It looks like right now, the pendulum is swinging towards the solenoidal geometry, I would say, with the abracadabra experiment, which was the main thing, at least in the US, switching from toroidal to solenoid. Okay, so that's the magnetic response. So electric response, so the second most obvious thing you could do besides creating a transformer coil is just put a conductor into this system. And now, if there's an oscillating electric field due to the axions, we know that near the surface of the conductor, there's a boundary condition that electrons are going to move to satisfy this boundary condition of no parallel electric field at the conductor. And so the way that's achieved is that there's a real electromagnetic wave that's launched out of the surface, and at the surface it cancels to zero. But what you do get is whenever you have a conductor inside the magnet, it becomes a weak source of electromagnetic radiation at the frequency of the axion mass. And so then there were these proposals for dish antenna experiments, the original paper by Horns, Jekyll, Linder, and so on in 2012. So I'm actually not sure why this conceptually is the thing that seems to me more obvious than the proposal of Pierre Sakivi, which I'll get to in a second with the resonant cavity. But for some reason, it was delayed by 20 or 30 years. Anyway, the proposal is you have a metal surface and you curve the surface, and you have you arrange for a magnetic field component to be parallel to it. And then at the focus of this surface, you put a detector for this weak radiation. And the problem is it's really weak. It's, even for pretty optimistic choices of emission area and magnetic field, you get on the order of 10 to the minus 25 watts of power, which is just, that's just a really small number. And 30 years ago, you wouldn't really probably have thought of detecting that. So maybe someone did consider it, but considered this just a throwaway idea, didn't publish it. So Pierre Tsukivi's idea was, instead of just one emitting surface, make a box. And so then the box has resonant conditions. A whole number of wavelengths needs to fit inside the box. And so when you get the cavity has these not natural resonant frequencies, and when one of them matches the axion frequency, you get a resonant power enhancement due to the cavity mode being pumped by the induced field from the axions. And it turns out that in practical situations, you can get at least three orders of magnitude enhancement in signal power. And this then put the signal into the reach of the conventional, of the amplifiers that existed even in the 1980s, based on cooled transistors. So they used originally high electron mobility transistors with noise figures like 4 Kelvin noise temperature. And this, there were a series of experiments, ADMX and Rochester Brookhaven Fermilab, other things in the 1980s. Now there are, I think, around 10 groups worldwide that are pursuing this type of project. So in terms of what mass range these different techniques are useful for, there's good complementarity. So in this micro EV plus or minus one decade region, the cavity resonators are probably the best technique. If you go to lower frequency, it's the lumped element resonators like abracadabra and shaft. At still lower frequencies, there are experiments down to the kilohertz using nuclear magnetic resonance, looking at the torques induced on nuclei by the axion field. And then in the higher frequency region, there are dish antennas and the dielectric disk experiments that I won't have time to talk about. So the resonator experiments, which are still, this is really still the dominant technique, and ADMX is the leading collaboration. These are my collaborators on ADMX at a meeting in Washington, Leslie Rosenberg, who historically led the collaboration in the center. And this is what our detector looks like. It's a pretty big magnet. I'll show you where this stands in the list of the world's top 100 or top 20 or whatever later. It's a pretty big magnet, not the biggest. 8 Tesla, not the highest field, but respectable. A big, microwave cavity with a volume of around 100 liters. Some tuning rods, which I'll talk about. And then because, an unfortunate aspect of this business is all the low noise amplifiers require very low magnetic fields. They're based on superconductors. And so you have to create a low magnetic field region very close to the high magnetic field region in order to have these amplifiers work. So, and that's what it looks like in reality. So there's another view of the amplifier, and there's a view of the cavity with tuning rods. So you can see what size it is, and you move these rods around to change the frequency of the cavity. And you do that with mechanical actuators, gearboxes. There are two gearboxes that control the two rods, and you can squeeze the dominant cavity mode and change its frequency by moving these rods in or pulling them out. And then there's another gearbox that controls the antenna, which tunes, which there's an optimal coupling of the antenna to the cavity. It turns out that you want to arrange things so half of the total power is leaving through the antenna, and about half is dissipated on the cavity walls. That turns out to give optimal signal to noise. The signal power you get for typical parameters is on the order of 10 to the minus 23 watts. This is for the 7.5 Tesla. There's a form factor here, which depends on what cavity mode you're using, and it measures the overlap of the axion-induced electric field spatially with the spatial distribution of the field that is in that natural mode of the cavity. So unfortunately, you might think, why don't I just use higher, as I go up in frequency, why don't I use higher modes of the cavity? All these experiments basically are done on the lowest mode. And the reason is that this form factor is heavily suppressed for all higher modes. For many of them, it's zero, because the cavity mode has a part of it where the electric field is pointing in one direction and part of it where the field is pointing in the other direction. whereas the axion field is just always pointing in the same direction along the whole cavity. So the spatial average of this of the pumping is zero in these higher modes. Some of them have a little bit of sensitivity, but in practice, they haven't been very powerful for these experiments.
Also, the quality factor changes the model.
The quality factor changes as you go up in frequency, but that's going to happen anyway because the higher, you know, that's going to happen anyway. Even if you build a smaller cavity at a higher frequency, you'll have lower quality factor because of skin depth effects. The current is flowing in, you know, in a smaller amount of material. So the real advance in the last decade has been on the amplifier side, and it's come because our colleagues who do quantum computing experiments have had huge resources to develop low noise amplifiers for reading out qubits. I think it's fair to say that that's the reason the field has really progressed. So compared to the 20 years ago when you would have a noise temperature of 4 Kelvin, now you can have a noise temperature of 400 millikelvin because of all these developments. So there are now many devices, well, at least a handful of devices of this type. The first ones we used were microstrip squid amplifiers, which is essentially a squid. Most squids are designed for low frequency, like 100 megahertz operation. And you had to electrically couple the signal at gigahertz frequencies into a squid. And so the engineering for this was done by John Clark at Berkeley, who's sort of the most important person perhaps in development of squids over the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. More recently, we used Josephson parametric amplifiers, which have become a workhorse for qubit-based computers. These are developed by Irfan Siddiqui at UC Berkeley and now our colleagues at Washington University in St. Louis as well. And there's another device called a traveling wave parametric amplifier, which is it's another type of superconducting amplifier based on Josephson junctions, but it provides very large instantaneous bandwidth. So if you wanted to search a wide range of frequencies all at once, then this would be a great choice as an amplifier. And typically there are multiple stages. It's more complicated than just a single device. There are multiple stages of post-amplification, and there are signal injection paths for calibration and so forth, and the whole assembly ends up looking like this. We call this the squididel because it physically somewhat resembles a squid. And it has integrated magnetic shielding and the different RF devices you need to do calibration and so forth.
So when you say wide bandwidth, is it more than 1 E-fold or something?
It is about a factor of 10. Well, no, sorry, that's not right. So it's typically a factor of 2. So you can easily get amplifiers now that cover from 4 to 8 gigahertz. That's a very standard range for qubit readout now. So this is what the Josephson parametric amplifiers are really, are nonlinear oscillators, which are pumped with a signal. The signal goes into them, but also a powerful pump tone. And the nonlinearity of the oscillator creates a mixing between the signal and the pump. It's analogous to what happens with laser media, where there are laser amplifiers that work in the same way. There's some kind of nonlinear medium where you introduce a pump tone and a signal tone, and you get out an amplified signal tone it's one of the things you get out. So these things involve pretty sophisticated microelectronics techniques applied now to superconducting electronics. There's a tendency in now to apply all the things that have been used to produce integrated circuits. Now they're being applied to superconducting circuits. So there are facilities where you can get very sophisticated superconducting circuits with thousands of Josephson junctions, maybe hundreds of thousands of Josephson junctions on them, and it's turning into a whole industry for superconducting electronics fabrication. So in fact, here's a commercial device that appeared in the last year. Now, if you want to do an experiment, maybe you'll get into doing some experiments here at Perimeter, you can go buy your wideband Josephson parametric amplifier from Raytheon. And apparently these things work pretty well. So it's become a pretty standard technology, which also means maybe the barriers to entry in the axion field are not as high as they used to be. So it turns out that even with these amplifiers, it isn't just a single shot measurement. We have to average the noise over many measurements in order to get down to see the signal. In fact, even if we were down at the level of vacuum noise, so the quantum noise from the lowest state of the, considering the cavity as a harmonic oscillator in its ground state, that noise is still a couple of orders of magnitude bigger than our axion signal. So I find that's pretty remarkable, is that the axion signal is smaller than the vacuum noise. But luckily, we can average the vacuum noise down. In fact, if we wanted to, we could go to a tiny fraction of the DFSC power. This is 0.1% after averaging for a month. We usually don't average for a month. We average for only 100 seconds. And in 100 seconds, we take a million samples. And that's enough to reach DFSC sensitivity at our noise level, if assuming the system is working the way it's supposed to, which it does at least some of the time. So this is the way the experiment works. You scan over a spectral region corresponding to the cavity, usually a little bit more than the cavity Q width, and then you move the tuning rods a tiny fraction of a Q width. You scan again, and if you saw a signal, it would look like this. It would be present in multiple tunings of the cavity, but always at the same frequency. And it would follow. It would fall away as the cavity, as the width of the cavity resonance passed over the signal. It would be attenuated.
So the sensitivity is purely limited then by exposure.
The sensitivity, yes. So you need exposure.
That's it.
You're averaging noise for long periods of time.
That's what sets your water exposure time that you just said that you use.
Yes, so that's why.
Just to cover the QCD axon and then you stop.
That's right. We could choose to drill down deeper in one place if we really wanted to, but we distribute our lifetime over the frequency range. And so there are actually a lot of checks to see if you have an axion. So let's suppose you see a power excess at some frequency. There's a list of things you do. Is this a radio station? Can you see it in the room outside the magnet? Is it there all the time or does it go away? Does it follow the expected resonant shape of the cavity? Is it missing in the modes that have a poor form factor for coupling to axions, or is it still there? And actually, and after that, this kills, those considerations there already kill almost everything. What we've discovered is that at that point, what's left over is we have a calibration team that blindly injects fake signals into the detector at random frequencies, and they keep a list of what they injected, so that once we get to this point, we can go and say, "Hey, like this thing's not going away. Did you put this in?" And so far, that's the only thing. Nothing has persisted beyond that point. If they said no, hey, we didn't do anything, then the next thing would be to ramp the magnet down and see if the signal was still there. We don't want to do that because the magnet takes more than a week to ramp down, and we have to stop the search, and then beyond that, we'd look at an annual modulation frequency, corresponding to the Earth's motion through the halo. But we hadn't had to do any of this stuff because we eliminated all the candidates before that. And this is our sensitivity plot from the last our last publication.
How frequently did you get to the point where you're asking the synthetic
Well, they try to put a few events into each run. So at the end of each run, there should have been an event. If there was nothing there, then you have to wonder, were you really sensitive? So that keeps... It keeps us honest, but in order for that to work, they have to put some small handful of signals into the data set.
So order once a run, you're kind of finding.
Yeah, or order once a run. We don't want to spend a lot of time investigating signals only to discover that they're just injected calibration signals. So you don't do, we don't do a lot of them. So those are these are our results, and this ADMX is the first experiment to get to DFSZ sensitivity. And now I haven't updated this plot since the summer, but now CAP has also got in there in a very similar setup in Korea. And then usually the runs, I wish we could say that we just scanned the region we were expecting to and then moved on, you know, then moved on to the next, but usually there's some kind of unplanned event, such as your liquefier breaking and having to be hauled back to the manufacturer and replaced, and then you start, you know, once you fix that, you start a new run. Okay, so how do you go up to higher frequencies? So unfortunately, this doesn't scale very well to higher frequencies because the as you move up in frequency, the cavity gets smaller because of this, because it's you're only using the lowest order mode of the cavity, so it physically gets smaller in all three dimensions. So the volume is shrinking like one over the frequency cubed, and the quality resonator quality factor is also decreasing as you go up by a more modest amount, having to do with the skin depth changing. And also the standard the vacuum noise from the standard quantum limit is going up as frequency. So you have this, all of this has a really together has a terrible effect on the signal to noise ratio. And this is the scan rate, which right now in principle is 1.68 gigahertz per year, although in practice we've never actually achieved that rate. But if everything is working well, we could get there. To keep this up as you go up in frequency, you'd like a stronger magnet, more detector volume, which could be achieved not in a single resonator, but by combining arrays of them, power combining signals. Higher Q, which could be achieved by making the cavity a superconductor. That's non-trivial to do because it's in a huge magnetic field, which ruins the superconductivity of type 1 superconductors. A type 2 superconductor maybe will work. We have collaborators who are trying to put type 2 superconducting coatings on these cavities to get higher Q. And then you could go to lower noise amplifiers, but you know, you're already at the quantum limit. So you'd have to use some scheme to get around the quantum limit using squeezed states to go to lower noise.
So like when you are doing type 2, you are expecting to have like all the vortex lattice, and somehow that's not a problem?
Well, it is going to be a problem. So the vortex lattice is causes the vortices get shaken around by the magnetic field and cause dissipation. Right. So you will not reach Qs anything like what you have in type 1 superconductors in no magnetic field, where, you know, for example, in particle accelerators now, Qs are 10 to the 10, I believe, maybe 10 to the 11. We would be happy. Our highest Q cavities have 10 to the 5. So actually, we'd be happy just to, even a factor of 2 makes a difference. So if you can get some modest advantage from using a type 2 superconductor, taking into account the dissipation from the vortices, then you would still win. But it might be worse than copper, so if you're not careful, so it could be worse than a normal conductor. But the indications are that there might be an order of magnitude, basically, if you, depending on the superconductor you used. The best would be to use YBCO. They're very magnetic field tolerant. Actually, this slide is about that, but in the context of magnets, the manufacturing issues are quite severe. So here, this is the current magnet. Wouldn't it be great if we could go from 7.5 Tesla to 30 Tesla? So now, in the last few years, a 30 Tesla small bore magnet has been demonstrated by the National High Magnetic Field Lab. The scan speed goes as the fourth power of the magnetic field. So this would be huge for these experiments. But it's right now still very expensive and not that practical for us to scale to the size of the magnet we need, because even though the central field is very high, the stored energy B squared, which is the real metric, the most more important metric, is still low. There's some indication that the magnetic fusion energy community will solve this problem by investing billions of dollars in developing new conductors, which is really what's required to get to create the manufacturing capability where the magnets become affordable. But for now, so this is a plot of the applied magnetic field and the critical current that can be sustained in a coil. And so this shows niobium titanium is by far the dominant material for winding superconducting magnets. And you can see that it's plunging toward the current, critical current is plunging towards zero at about 10 Tesla, which explains why the niobium titanium wires never really exceed about, those magnets never exceed about 9 to 10 Tesla in peak field. But then with these alternative materials, if they become practical, you could have significant currents even at 40 Tesla, maybe even at 100 Tesla. There are severe mechanical engineering constraints because the magnets attempt to rip themselves apart, at those high fields. And so there's a lot of engineering that goes into that. There's interest even at Fermilab in producing a large diameter 30 Tesla magnet for muon cooling experiments, or eventually for a muon collider. So there are a lot of people interested in this, and a fusion company last summer demonstrated a 20 Tesla magnet coil with a sort of 1 meter scale size. But we studied this for our proposal for a next generation experiment, and our conclusion was better to stay with niobium titanium for now. These other things are not mature. They're going to cost more than we could afford to spend on an experiment. So actually, we found a really nice magnet which has an order of magnitude more stored energy than the ADMX magnet at a hospital in Chicago. It's one of the highest field MRI magnets ever built. And for some reason, high field MRI is not progressing. This is not the one that every hospital has, which is like 1.5 Tesla. So this is a 9.5 Tesla MRI magnet. There are only a few of these that have ever been made, but they don't seem to, high field MRI doesn't seem to have caught on, and they actually are terminating their research program at this hospital. So they're offering us this magnet for free, and we're attempting to integrate this into our next experiment. So the experiment is called ADMX Extended Frequency Range, and it would be installed ideally at Fermilab starting in 2024 and ending in 2026. And so it'd be this big horizontal magnet with two dilution refrigerators and an array of cavities. I think I have a cavity array here on the next slide. Yeah, these are the cavities. So they have a single tuning rod and an external armature to keep everything in good alignment. And you put them together, they're hexagonally packed into an array of 19 to fill up the volume of the magnet. And they're tuned using miniature piezoelectric actuators, which amazingly are commercially available things that you can even work in this high magnetic field and low temperature environment. So this shows the evolution of the resonator. So this is what we've got now. Sadly, each time I show this slide, I have to change the dates of when these things are going to be used. But right now, so I'd say I probably have to push this up to now to 2026 to 2028. Anyway, you get the idea. So we're going from simple single cavities to more complicated multi-cavities to pretty complicated, 10 or 20 cavity systems. And you might ask, how far can you go? So a lot of people, us included, have tried to develop higher frequency cavity systems based on more complicated geometries, like things called the pizza cavity or the comb cavity or the photonic band gap cavities. So all these different schemes. One thing they have in common is they tend to depend on very, very precise mechanical positioning of these small components. And that's very challenging to do. And it's very challenging to check that you actually achieved the result that you wanted to have. So this is hard. People are working on it, but it's not an easy thing to do. So, here's our frequency range going into the future with those higher frequency bands. So these are funded. These two lower bands are funded projects by the DOE, and we're about to install this Run 1D package this year, and then Run 2A package will happen about 2 years from now. So we just keep marching up, and then this EFR experiment, that's with the bigger magnet at Fermilab.
Here you won't get to the Q3 epsilon 9, will you, in your projections?
All these would get to the QCD axiom 1, which is here, KSVZ, DFSC. Yeah, they all, so these are all designed to operate at DFSC sensitivity, and to take sort of a year or two per setup to run.
And just one brief question. So, and why, if these experiments are limited by exposure, why CAP doesn't get to the QCD axiom 9, for instance?
Well, I need to update this with this summer's result. So they need, they didn't have a combination of a big powerful magnet, low noise amplifiers, and exposure time. So it's all those things together. Even achieving the exposure time is non-trivial. I mean, you have to keep this thing running and not have stuff not break. So it's not just like you plugged it in and turned it on. But the more important thing is, are the amplifiers working at the noise performance that you wanted?
And this RBF, what's RBF?
RBF is one of the first generation of experiments in the 1990s, I think, or even late 1980s. It's Rochester, Brookhaven, Fermilab. And so that's a very early result with 4 Kelvin, or 4 to, sort of maybe 10 Kelvin noise temperature. So now I'm going to switch and talk about the dish antenna idea. So going back to this picture of the radiation produced by a conductor, when you have this oscillating field from the axion, and it's balanced to achieve to have a net cancellation, so that you have zero electric field at the surface of the conductor, and you have an emitted plane wave. So power is really small. But on the other hand, the great thing is you can get away from all these very complicated mechanical structures that have to be precisely built and have to be moved at low temperature. Or these huge numbers of single cell resonators that are ganged together. That's why when we were stuck on those problems of how to gang together huge resonators, we tried to come up with ideas of how to do it with this type of system, so we wouldn't have to do that anymore. So anyway, this dish radiator that was in the original Horns et al. Concept paper, this is not really practical from an engineering point of view, because it's hard to get, there's no magnet that you can easily build where the magnetic field is mostly parallel to a curved surface in three dimensions. That doesn't correspond to a realistic magnet geometry. So the Brass collaboration proposed to use a planar array of permanent magnets, something like the really powerful fridge magnets that would be stacked to make like a wall. And then you would point a parabolic or spherical dish, well, parabolic, they say, dish at the wall and put a detector here. So, that's an improvement. You can do that. But one problem is that these permanent magnets are limited to somewhat less than 2 tesla. And the signal goes as B squared. So you end up having to compensate by building a huge wall. And then if you wanted to do a cold experiment to achieve low noise figures, then you have to figure out how to cool down that huge wall that you just built. And that didn't seem, we were interested in deep cryogenic operation to use these more advanced superconducting sensor technologies. And so that didn't seem very practical to us. And plus, most of the magnets that are available that are big, they're solenoid. Solenoid magnet is by far the simplest thing to make. You just, conceptually, you just wrap the wire around a rod or something like that. Of course, it's much, much harder than that, but it's a very simple geometry. And there's a lot of room to grow from where we are. So by this figure of merit, which is proportional to, which is stored energy essentially, we are 12 The biggest solenoid is a 12,000. This is the ITER central solenoid for the fusion plant that's being built in France, where this magnet was built by General Atomics. It's a 13 Tesla magnet using niobium 310 superconductor, so a harder to work with superconductor, but nevertheless 2.6 meters. It's huge, enormous stored energy compared to what we have. And then the physically largest solenoid is the CMS central solenoid, which is like 4 Tesla, but is, says here, 6 meters in diameter. So how would you design a dish experiment to fit into one of these magnets? So we came up with this concept for how to do that, which is you put this funny shape, this tear-shaped reflector into the magnet. This reflector is actually a parabolic surface of revolution. And the idea here is that this line here is the wall of the magnet, and a wave is launched from the wall towards the center, hits the parabolic surface, and it bounces towards a virtual focus. But before it reaches the virtual focus, it encounters a conducting wall and then reflects again. And so the real focus turns out to be at the tip of this, up here, if you extended this, it turns out to be at the tip of this figure. So all the idea is that all the rays emitted from the wall end up focusing here, and they all actually have the same length. So this is a coherent device, just like a telescope. Everything will combine coherently. So this actually, I thought, wow, this is really cool. I've never seen this before in an optics textbook. And so I tried to go back and find, did we invent this or what? And this is what I found, the most similar thing, although my design has one extra bounce. But this was patented as a lighthouse mirror in the 1800s. And the idea is that the ships are on the horizon and you have a candle, I guess, or the central flame. You don't want to waste light by beaming it, up into space and down into the ocean. So this produces a beam that goes towards the horizon. And then this concept is the time-reversed version of that. So how would you do an experiment? There's three different kinds you can do. You can do a heterodyne detection experiment where you mix the signal with a local oscillator and mix it down to a low frequency and digitize it, much like ADMX. Or you could do a bolometer experiment where you put some really small mass at the focus and put a thermometer on it and waited for it to warm up due to the axion-induced power. Or you could do a photon counting experiment, which is really just like a bolometer experiment, except once the bolometer has sufficient amplitude and time resolution, you discover that the electromagnetic field is quantized and you start to see blips instead of some continuous heating. So we have ideas on how to do all three versions of this experiment. The first one is the easiest to implement, but because you're measuring the phase of the signal as well as its amplitude, there's a standard quantum limit that comes into play, which limits the noise performance. If you look at the best sensitivity you could possibly get for a pretty large radiator, it's only really the single photon counting, because there's no quantum limit there, that could probe the QCD parameter space over a very wide range. The bolometers don't have a quantum limit, but in terms of the state-of-the-art noise performance for bolometers, they fall quite short of being able to do that. And heterodyne detection can only do it at a very low axion mass.
How big is this thing? This thing is big, right? Your reflecting surface and everything, that's all big.
As big as you can afford.
How big is?
Well, the 10 meter one would be something like a 2 meter diameter solenoid. The surface of the inside of the bore would be around 10 square meters.
And then the reflecting thing itself, what is it?
Well, it can be any metal, but we think it's probably aluminum. And I'll show you in a minute, so you'll see what the prototypes look like.
And this is going to go underground?
For some kinds of sensors, where you were trying to detect single photons at a very low rate, basically here here I claimed that we wanted to get to one photon detected per day, which for a WIMP experimentalist is a reasonable signal. But it does, at least for, it may require putting the thing underground, but this regime of photon counting, especially at these frequencies, is not well explored yet. And so I do not know if there are tricks that would allow you to operate the experiment above ground. It's possible.
I see.
But the magnet, this magnet, like the ETER magnet, ETER actually made a spare coil, by the way. So I think once they built their fusion reactor, someone might ask them, hey, what are you doing with that spare coil that you manufactured, which cost $500 million? So we probably can't afford it even on, DOE high energy physics budget. But it's, people make these magnets for a specific purpose, and then their projects are over, and maybe we could acquire one cheap. So I'm not going to talk through this because there's other things I want to show about what we're actually doing, but this shows sort of the landscape of single photon detectors. So there are the red things are single photon detectors, which the blue ones are bolometer technologies, and the green ones are heterodyne detector technologies. So there's a preponderance, there's now a kind of growing preponderance of red in this figure. All these new technologies based on superconductors have been coming in over the last few years, and it may soon be possible to do single photon counting over the entire electromagnetic spectrum. So that's pretty exciting for physics in general, and particularly for these axion searches. They're just going to enable us to do all kinds of things. And so in our paper, which is shown here, this is the citation, we explored the sensitivity you could get with devices that actually do exist already or were not science fiction, so things that might exist in the next 10 years. So the solid lines correspond to things that are very solid and really exist, different kinds of, even here, this is a commercially available thing you can just buy out of a catalog. These are things that closely related to the sensors that cosmic microwave background experiments use. So it's actually easy to, you can search for dark photons without a magnet. The signal is very similar, and it's easy to make progress setting limits on the kinetic mixing parameter for dark photons using sensors that are readily available. The corresponding axion experiments where you put the detector in a magnet are more challenging, and you can't push much beyond existing limits with the off-the-shelf sensors. It does require advances in sensor technology. As an example of what's possible now, these are called single superconducting nanowire single photon detectors. They are thin meanders of superconductor that are biased with a current so that they're very close to switching into the normal state. A photon comes in and causes local heating and causes a momentary shift from superconducting to normal, which creates an electric pulse. And the remarkable thing about these is for reasonably large sensors, so 400 micron by 400 micron, our collaborators at NIST have measured less than, on the order of one dark count per day. So now it is possible in the infrared, where these sensors work, to measure count rates as low as one photon a day, which is just extraordinary. So that's the target. If you could extend that to the longer wavelength, then you could detect the QCD axion over huge, huge range in mass.
Sorry, that because in your projections, if you put in the SNSPD, the QCD axion line was below your projection, wasn't it?
It doesn't. So it's not that interesting. Searching for axions up there, this is sort of like one EV, and it's not that interesting because So the truth is that at the wavelengths where the SNSPDs are now sensitive, an axion search is not really interesting. There are already astrophysical limits up at those high masses, and you're also starting to get close to intersecting with this very broad mass experimental limit from the CAST experiment. So yeah, I guess it is interesting for dark photons, but as an axion search, it's more like a proof of principle that you know here there really are sensors, single photon sensors, that are starting to get to these count rates in background.
I see. And this key TS is just 0.1 or 1 mEV. What's this key TS? It's the blue or purple.
These are kinetic inductance. It's actually two detector technologies: kinetic inductance detectors and transition edge sensors. These are technologies which are used for cosmic microwave background experiments now.
Single photon counting, do they?
They do in the at higher energy. They have single photon counting capability.
Like 100 mEV, I guess.
Yeah, at 100 mEV. We have collaborators who believe that they are quite close to achieving single photon counting at.
Sorry, I saw. Yeah. Is assuming some barometer like noise power, right?
Yeah. So the barometer noise power. Well, I think this is a single photon counter, as I recall, but it's not. You know, there will be some dark count rate of single photon counting, and it's not demonstrated yet. But it seems like it's a within 10 years type of technology that you could do that. So we have we have collaborators who have a grant to push single photon counting with TESs down towards terahertz.
Yeah.
So this is the pilot experiment we want to do with SNSPDs, which will be pointed at a dark photon search. This is a cryostat that we happen to have around, and we're building a prototype detector inside it. And this is what you could do with an SNSPD with a day of integration, is you could measure these very small mixing parameters.
So this is like it's a huge thing. So what's the reactivity rate of whatever material you plan to use as your aluminum mirror, for instance?
It's not. So we don't think that we don't think that at these rates the radioactivity of that material is going to be relevant. This is an optical system, right? So it is, I mean, at some point radioactivity could become an issue, but there are already people operating these sensors at at rates of a count a day in an ordinary
device, right? It's like a tabletop thing like this size.
Well, this is about a tabletop thing too. This is 40 centimeters in diameter.
I thought it was like 10 meters.
No, I should put a person here. A person would be about the same. This is about the size of a person. But also, I mean, it is so, okay. So the sensor itself has low mass and it's an optical system. So only the solid angle, it's not like any photon is going to find its way into that sensor. Only the ones that are emitted in just the right way.
But they're always there, right? I mean, if an electron from your aluminum is emitted, so the reactivity emits isotropically, if it emits in the right direction, for instance, so one thing that I will worry is that you will have transition radiation. So any electron that goes through the aluminum,
yes,
you just emit photons by transition radiation isotropically. You will have many of them. Some of them will have the right angle.
Like this, I think, is roughly the same structure as we have. So I think like the rate is.
Yeah, that's why I was asking about the size, because.
Well,
that only depends on the sensor size. It doesn't depend on the whole one.
I'm just like naively assuming more volume, more tracks, more photons flying around.
I think it's a reasonable concern. It's not one that we haven't looked into it very much.
Okay.
We haven't really thought. So this is actually something that my colleagues working on Sensei have brought up also.
Okay.
We know that they're plagued by similar problems in these Sensei and Ascura.
Yeah.
So at some point this could become an issue, and we would have to work on the radioactivity aspects. But let me show you a few more things because we're at the hour. So this shows how far we've gotten with this. We built a prototype reflector using conventional machining techniques, and it's really crappy as an optical device. It produces, if you shine a laser on it, you get this very diffuse scattering, and it shows it's not so easy to make a mirror, because it kind of looks mirror-like when you look into it. But if you try to do this type of test, you discover that the surface roughness is a very big problem. And we studied this using ray tracing. So we introduced sinusoidal perturbations into our structure in simulation with different wavelengths, and measured the dispersion and the focus caused by these perturbations in the structure. And so it turns out we're not trying to achieve a perfect focus, because the dark matter velocity dispersion itself causes a defocusing of the beam. And in our apparatus, the beam is expected by this, from this dark matter velocity dispersion, to be defocused to sort of millimeter scale. So we just need to keep the focus within not much worse than that. That requires surface accuracy as good as a few microns on the shortest wavelengths. For long wavelengths perturbations, we have much more freedom. It could be hundreds of microns. But still, this is beyond what you can achieve with just a conventional metal fabrication technique like you would use in an ordinary machine shop. And we made this first prototype in an ordinary machine shop, and then we measured it using this robot probe thing. And this shows the scatter in the surface dimensions. There's a large systematic deviation from the expected curve as you move in the vertical direction, and then on fine scales, there's quite a bit of scatter also horizontally. So this is all no good. It doesn't meet our requirements for the optical device. Luckily, industry has a solution for this. It's a thing called single point diamond turning. It's a rotating, it's a lathe, so which is a standard mechanical, machining technique, but it has very high precision spindle so that the part doesn't move around very much. And the cutting tool is a diamond, which comes to a very small point. And so with this tool, you can make optical devices. Like this is not one of our reflectors, but it's a similar type of thing where they creating an optic for a space telescope or something like that. So the only problem is, of course, this is expensive and a fancy technique, and so we have to find vendors that can do this. But we're working with Lawrence Livermore, that has a capability for some secret project they're working on to make these aluminum mirrors. And then we're also working, we've got in some sensors. So we have nanowire detectors from MIT and JPL. Those are labs have pioneered these things. And we have a laser diode, which goes into a fiber, which feeds the sensor. Sensors cool down to a few hundred millikelvin. We see in the last 6 months, now we see pulses from the nanowires, and we see the expected response to a laser. And we achieved dark counts so far of 10 to the minus 2 hertz. So that's where we are. So we're not at 10 to the minus 5, which is where we want to be. We're at 10 to the minus 2. But we suspect there's still light leaking into this system. But it's a good start. I think we're going to get there. So we also have a microwave frequency experiment which we call GigaBread, which will operate in the 10 to 20 gigahertz range. And there are not the same concerns at these long wavelengths about the fabrication quality. So actually we can use the prototypes which failed the quality control for the optical device. We can use those as for the low frequency search. And so we have a off the shelf amplifier, a mixer, and even with this very simple setup, you should be able to do world's best dark photon limits in some range in the gigahertz. One thing you do need is the data acquisition problem is quite complicated. There are a few things you need. One you need is you need a horn antenna, which is matched to the radiation emitted from the reflector. So we had to design our own horn antenna with a very particular radiation pattern to be well coupled. We've done that, and we've measured it in a microwave absorbing box, and we see that it has the right radiation pattern. And then the other thing is we need data acquisition over a very wide bandwidth. So we want to cover, let's say, a 4 gigahertz chunk of the spectrum all at once. So that requires like 8 billion numbers per second to be processed by some piece of electronics. But nowadays, with modern digital electronics, which I guess was developed for the cell phone industry, because a decade ago this would have been unthinkable, but you can process, in a single board, you can process that huge amount of data. You split it up into many channels using digital techniques, and then average it all on a single chip. And so then you read this into a computer only after it's been averaging on the chip for some amount of time. And this is a demonstration from just a week or two ago showing a very weak signal injected into the amplifier at this one gigahertz frequency, which only emerges from the noise after 320,000 noise averages. So that's pretty cool. We pretty much got what we need to do that experiment. And we've got the parts now. Here we're doing QA and all the parts for the GigaRed. And once we've done the dark photon search, then we just have to put this into a magnet. It's a really simple experiment because it's all at room temperature. So just take the thing you built, carry it to Argonne National Lab, and roll it in on this bed to the MRI magnet. And then you can get sort of, you know, interesting limits on dark photon, or sorry, on axion-like particles just from this simple setup. If you cooled it down to 4 Kelvin and integrated for a longer time, you could get here. And then we're thinking about ways that you could boost the sensitivity even further to get to the, you know, into the QCD axion band. And this is a different collaboration than ADMX. People at Fermilab, University of Chicago, MIT, Caltech now, and Slack. Okay, so this is my last slide. So I switched into this field because it's so exciting and dynamic right now, where the WIMP field was sort of like dying down a little bit in terms of the creativity you could apply. You just have to work on building a bigger and bigger tank of liquid xenon. This is super exciting. I always tell this to an audience of experimentalists. I tell people this, how exciting it is to play with all these tools. I'm not sure you guys will be as interested in it, but it's a super exciting subfield right now. Anyway, thank you. That's it. So I don't know, did we actually have people who were on the Zoom? Hi, Masha.
I'm here. Hello.
Yes. Question? What are the prospects of going down the other direction? You kind of went up to higher masses?
Well, they're better with the resonant detectors. So definitely, with the resonant detectors, it's easy to get an octave. And then the LC oscillator experiments, so which I touched on, those can go down by several decades, and prospects are good. I don't have they claim that they can get into the QCD band. The results so far are not that great. There's a long way to go, but people haven't worked on that very much. You know, that's really just the beginning. So I expect it will take a long time, but in principle, with enough resources, they can get there, as far as I understand.
So the time frame to march down to the QCD line, to do to us here what you did to us in the WIMP case, how long are we talking about?
Probably about the same amount of time, 20 years. 30 years. It's going to take some time.
is the whole device reflecting? So there's the cone, the balls, and then the top. Is it all reflecting?
Well, it is. I mean, only certain surfaces are finished optical surfaces, so they're not. Those depending on the wavelength, all those surfaces will reflect. Oh, what we do? Okay, we do introduce an absorbing surface. So there's one intentionally. There's one absorbing surface that's introduced on purpose in order to damp out resonances. I'm not sure if that's what the question is about.
Yeah,
otherwise,
everything's reflecting. You will have a bath of non-thermal photons just bouncing around until they hit the detector.
Yeah. So we are putting in a cold absorber in one place. In one location to swallow up the background radiation that's just bouncing around, otherwise would bounce around forever.
Right.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot.